You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup with the latest on the deadly fires on Maui. Plus, Ohio becomes the latest state to send a strong message on abortion. And Zoom joins other companies urging its workers back to the office. Those stories and more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, 16 Michigan Republicans were charged with felonies last month for signing and submitting papers claiming that they were electors for Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election after Joe Biden carried that state. Here in Wisconsin, 10 Republicans also signed papers claiming they were electors. They aren't facing criminal charges, but a civil suit against them is going ahead after a court ruling yesterday. Governor Evers and others have called for criminal investigations. The so-called fake electors in Michigan, Wisconsin, and five other states are key parts of the latest federal indictments against former President Trump for his actions after the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these would-be electors? Do you think they should face criminal charges here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly Beck is the senior capital reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you take us back to 2020, December, the Democrats, Democratic electors, after Joe Biden had won the state, they're signing their elector papers. What else was going on with the Republicans we're talking about?
Yeah, so I was covering the Capitol at the time, and we heard while the Democratic electors were meeting in the Capitol, we heard there was a group of Republicans meeting in the Capitol at the same time, potentially to sign similar paperwork. And so all of that turned out to be true, as we know now. And at the time, the Republicans were arguing similar arguments they're making today, that they were signing this paperwork just in case legal challenges to the outcome of the election were successful in Wisconsin. They met after sort of the last ditch effort by former President Donald Trump and his supporters. You know, that last lawsuit failed and the Supreme Court tossed it. They signed the paperwork anyway, but there wasn't a legal challenge at play at that moment when they did that.
As I mentioned, in Michigan, we have these criminal charges against the people who did a similar thing in Michigan. As far as we know, the big question mark, there's no similar investigation, at least not publicly acknowledged here in Wisconsin. What have the Attorney General and others said about that?
That's right. The Attorney General, Josh Call, has avoided talking about this in specifics. I know that, like you mentioned, the Democratic governor, Tony Evers, he said recently that he believes that the group of Republicans who signed that false paperwork should be held accountable by the justice system. Josh Call has avoided, you know, weighing in on that one way or the other. At one point earlier this summer, the governor said that he believed the attorney general was kind of leaning on federal investigators to handle the accountability aspect, and that he supported that. So his latest statement is a bit of a shift, but we still don't know, you know, exactly what the State Department of Justice is doing, if anything at all.
And you've covered some breaking news this week. Now, no criminal case going on here, but there's a civil suit going on, and it took a step forward yesterday. What's going on?
That's right. There's a civil case that is brought by the actual 2020 electors, the Democrats who signed paperwork for Joe Biden, who won Wisconsin in 2020 by about 20,000 votes. They filed a lawsuit against the Republican electors who claimed to be the correct electors, but were not. And that case is set for trial next year in September of 2024. So just, you know, a couple months before the next presidential election. There was a motion to dismiss the case that came from the defendants that Dane County Judge Frank Remington on Thursday, he rejected that motion to dismiss the case. One of the arguments that the Republicans made was that their actions did not amount to participating in a conspiracy to defraud Wisconsin voters. He rejected that argument in his order.
this whole story, Molly, is getting new attention now because of the latest federal indictments against former President Trump, because these self-proclaimed electors are a key part of the alleged in these indictments conspiracy by the former president and his supporters. This is seems like it's revived a lot of interest in the elector story, right?
Yeah, I mean, the latest indictment of former President Trump, it really hinges on this fake elector strategy that it looks like a Wisconsin attorney was the first person to be notified of. You know, it kind of, you know, started in Wisconsin in some ways. So I know in Wisconsin, at least, there is a renewed interest. I wouldn't say that the interest went away since this first happened. I receive a lot of reader emails about it, and especially with the U.S. House investigation in January 6th, there was a lot of information about this fake elector strategy during the course of that too. So it's been something that I think have been on, you know, readers' minds and certainly the people involved.
Molly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you for having me.
That's Molly Beck, senior Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us for a look at the latest news on the Republicans who signed papers claiming to be Wisconsin electors for Donald Trump after the 2020 presidential election. Our next guest is a politics and law expert joining us for a look at possible legal consequences for the so-called fake electors here in Wisconsin and the role of the Electoral College in general. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about the campaign to have people sign these elector papers in states that Joe Biden had won? Thoughts on the Electoral College itself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Kuntz is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We have these charges in Michigan. We have some calls for charges here in Wisconsin for the Republicans who signed these elector papers. One tricky thing here is that, Adam, it doesn't seem like we have a lot of precedent to go by. We don't have a lot of comparable stories over American history, do we?
No, we really don't. Honestly, we're in uncharted territory in a lot of ways. You see shenanigans like this happening with the Electoral College back in the 19th century. But nothing to this magnitude, and certainly not anything in the last, you know, perceivable lifetime. So this is new, and there aren't a ton of cases out there that I think we can really draw from to give us some guidance as to what would happen here in Wisconsin.
Now, there's two different threads on the elector story when it comes to courts of law. We have this federal indictment saying, hey, there is a conspiracy by the former president and his supporters to use these electors to gin up a claim of contested elections in states. But in the individual states, like here in Wisconsin, as we just heard from Molly, the individual Republicans who signed these things were saying, hey, no, we're just doing this in case courts flip this thing. We have to have these electors in place in that contingency. Does that seem like two potentially very different court cases with that federal one versus what's going on in the states?
You know, it seems like it's all different from one another, but it really is wrapped up the same. And that's partially because of what the Constitution does. The Constitution anticipates that we're going to have federal elections like those for the president, but it leaves it to the states to decide how those elections get done. And so there's always been this very, very complex interplay between what the federal government oversees with regard to elections and then what the states do on the ground to actually get those people elected. So on the one hand, we have these investigations into President Trump, or former President Trump, his advisors, what they knew, what they were intending to have done. And then we have the real actors on the ground, the foot soldiers, the ones who are actually using state law to enact or pursue the election route that they're on. And the two really blend very well together. And individuals who would be considered to be fake electors could potentially be charged under both federal and state laws, because there are, two tiers of laws that we're talking about here.
One seemingly small distinction that could be important. Now, in Pennsylvania, and I think also New Mexico, the Republicans who signed these papers included a clause that said something like, we're the electors if the courts rule and overturn what we now see as the outcome. Wisconsin, Michigan, that wasn't part of the statement. Is that important?
I think at least if I were a person in Pennsylvania, I'd definitely be hanging my hat on that phrasing for sure. And I believe I can't remember which Trump attorney it was, but they expressed some doubt here in Wisconsin as well. But that language was actually not put on any of the filings that came from Wisconsin, along with five of the other states. Interestingly enough, Wisconsin's certification that was sent was virtually identical in every other way to the other five states. I mean, the seal that was put on it looked like it was literally photocopied. So we're talking about the exact same document being filed in multiple different states. I don't think when it comes to the prosecution on the state side here in Wisconsin, the claim that, well, we were waiting to see whether or not litigation was going to go through is really going to have much of a leg to stand on, because as Molly pointed out in the previous segment, these filings were done well after the litigation was over here in Wisconsin. So December 14th meeting happened well after any kind of claim that, well, we're waiting to see what happens when this litigation concludes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program this evening. I honestly, when I heard this happened in 2020, I was just mortified, and I'm still mortified that these people, when they're false electors, they tried to defraud the people who voted for Joe Biden. If I made a mistake and voted twice, there would be severe consequences for me personally. I don't understand why we've waited so long to do something about them trying to defraud the people who voted for Joe Biden. It's so wrong.
Christine,
thank you.
Christine, thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
Well, I have two thoughts. One is I commiserate with Christine in that it seems like the wheels of justice move very slowly. I commend the folks in Michigan who are moving on this fairly quickly. They have evidence in front of them that they, prosecutors feel very comfortable taking something to trial if they know they have the evidence to convict. And Josh Call is being careful about this. I want to trust that he is doing his job as a good attorney general would and looking at the facts. So I commiserate with that. The second part of this, though, is that the civil litigation is currently pending right now, which is a unique thread here in Wisconsin, that we have a class of people who are actually suing these individuals, basically on behalf of all of us here in the state of Wisconsin. And so there could be, I'm reading the tea leaves here, there could be an effort on the part of the prosecutors to kind of wait and see what happens. With this motion to dismiss that was rejected, they're going to move now into the discovery phase of that civil litigation, which is going to uncover a whole trove of information over the next year that might prove potentially useful in a criminal investigation.
Christine, thanks for that call. We're talking to UW Eau Claire political science professor Adam Kuntz about whether we might see prosecution of the 10 Wisconsin Republicans who signed documents claiming to be electors for Donald Trump after the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think these so-called fake electors should face some kind of consequences for this? Or do you agree with their argument that, hey, they were keeping their legal options open if a court still went on to flip the election in favor of Donald Trump in that year? Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Adam Kuntz, assistant professor of political science at UW Eau Claire. We're talking about the Wisconsin Republicans who signed documents claiming to be electors for Donald Trump after the 2020 election, whether they might face criminal charges. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Adam, briefly before I go back to our callers, 2020 saw some strains in the use of the Electoral College. A lot of these things were formalities in most other elections. They were used as points of attack to try to change the outcome. Do you see a need for clarifications, changes into the Electoral College process from, Election Day to Inauguration Day?
You know, my opinion of this comes both as a citizen, which is something that I think everybody should have, but also as somebody who studies this as an expert. And to be quite honest with you, the Electoral College really is something that's been in need of an update for a very long time. It began as basically this separate institution. Alexander Hamilton envisioned it as a board of people that would ultimately be deciding the president. We would have some say in choosing who those individuals were, but ultimately they got to be the ones to make the call. We have to point out at that time period, though, in 1776, there were 2.5 million people, and in 1790, there were 3.9 million people in the United States. And if my math is correct, that's, you know, well under the size of the population of just Wisconsin alone. And so you do kind of have to wonder if popular sovereignty and direct democracy are things that we should care a little bit more about. We have made inroads with that with the Electoral College. We have added more democratic elements to it. For example, many states now send all of their popular votes towards their electors that are going to be chosen for the Electoral College. Here in Wisconsin, we say, if you win the state of Wisconsin with the popular vote, you get all of the electors, which is why the behind the story of all this, there's two groups of electors. There's the Democratic electors that were ultimately the ones certified, and then these 10 Republican electors that were trying to be certified. And I think there's so many ways that you can improve upon it, but one very easy way to improve upon the Electoral College is to just simply shift to a popular system that uses a what often gets referred to as a ranked choice system. Instead of simply just voting for a candidate and calling it done, you rank those that you are from, you know, best to least favorite, and then you do a series of runoff elections that choose from those top three, top two, et cetera, until you narrow down to that one person. But this process of voters voting for people who then ultimately are certifying things to state legislatures, who then certify something to Congress, who then certify something to the American people, that's 5, 6, 7 layers of decision making that needs to be done, which just opens the door to all manner of what I tell my students are shenanigans.
Go back to our callers. Ryan is with us in Glendale. Ryan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As divisive as I find and distasteful because of its divisiveness, that I find this in the short term, I think in the long run, it's going to be necessary to criminally prosecute these false electors in Wisconsin and elsewhere, because failure to do so is sort of a tacit endorsement of these kinds of electoral shenanigans, to use your guest phrase, and that if there's not any kind of criminal prosecution, wherever the chips may fall as a result of that prosecution, these kind of tactics are still seen as options in the future.
Interesting, Ryan. Thanks for the call. Adam, yeah, why not alternate electors in every state, if Ryan says, if there's no consequences?
I think you're exactly right. I think we talk a lot about legal precedent, which we don't have a lot of here, but there is such a thing as political precedent. And when one has claims the right or the blank check to be able to do something and doesn't quite get to do it this time around, it just opens the door for the person to do it again in the future. And that's why I think it should be, as your caller, I think, rightly points out, it is frustrating. It is distasteful. It is difficult to see us prosecuting former elected officials and indicting, you know, citizens who are trying to be electors. But at the same time, I think the thing that needs to be bear in mind is that this really is a bipartisan issue. If you're not afraid or concerned with the things that happen now, imagine if the other party did this in the future. Imagine if the next person in power did this. Would you want that to happen? And I think those kinds of universal and mutually agreed upon rules are literally the heart and soul of our government. And if we begin to reject those, then we really are becoming just a massively fractured community that would do its best to simply separate itself from one another.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'd first like to point out that it is high time we just abolish the Electoral College on the basis that those people get to vote twice and nobody else does. But my main point is that the people who participated in this fraud and scam knew it was a fraud and a scam from day one. They should be held criminally and civilly liable 100%. And if we could strip them of their right to vote in the future, that would be the absolute perfect solution.
Tom, thanks for the call. Adam, I know some of the Michigan electors who are facing felony charges said they were misled. They said that they did what they were told by legal counsel. Does it matter if they can establish that, no, they did this thinking it was a legitimate exercise?
Well, that always is a defense to conspiracy. Many of these people are going to be charged as not as actual actors, but as part of a conspiracy, conspirators to committing this. So, for example, here in Wisconsin, they would probably be charged under a similar forgery law that is being cited in Michigan. Our forgery law makes it a Class H felony and 6 years of jail time and a fine. And part of that, though, is you have to prove that the person knowingly intended to do this. And the co-conspirators have to essentially have similar levels of understanding. They have to essentially know that they're in on it, or that they reasonably had to know that they were in on it. And so that will be ultimately the question here. I think there in all of these cases, it is going to come down to circumstantial evidence. What was said over text messages? What was communicated to people? We do know that Chesbro and Tropas, they did advise people to meet. They did enlist State Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald to find them a room on the Capitol grounds to have the meeting. We know that the meeting took place, and we know that the electors signed a document, and that document was sent to Congress in the effort to try to get it certified. Now, what those individual electors were knowing at the time, that's the key question.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Adam Coates from UW-Eau Claire, political scientist. He was with us to talk about potential legal consequences for the Wisconsin Republicans who signed documents claiming to be electors for Donald Trump, this coming up after the 2020 election. First, if we want lessons in enjoying life, we can learn a lot from the French and their concept of joie de vivre, the French term that translates loosely to joy of living. That's according to our next guest, who has spent years living in France and wants to share what she's learned about the French approach to food, work, art, and even time, and how it can increase the joy we experience in day-to-day life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived or worked or vacationed in France? What did you like or dislike, or what puzzled you about French culture? How do you bring joy, joie de vivre, into your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathy Yandel is a professor of French and Francophone studies at Carleton College in Minnesota. She's the author and editor of books about French culture, literature, and history. Her latest book is called The French Art of Living Well: Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. She's giving a presentation at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee tonight at 6:30. Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
I apologize at the outset for my French pronunciation. Now, you say joie de vivre is a uniquely French concept. How do you try to translate that into American for us?
Well, I think you did a good job. I think joie de vivre, literally joy of living, is a pretty good start. But I find it interesting that even the English language dictionary and Webster's, you see joie de vivre as an English word because they can't quite translate all of the concepts that are bound up in that. So I find that really amusing, which is actually what got me onto the subject in the first place.
And you've been so close to France for so many years, but it wasn't always that way. Can you tell us about your first experience getting off, literally off a boat into France as an American? What struck you at first?
Well, since I come from New Mexico, first of all, taking a ship over, which was what students did. I was on one of the last crossings of the SS France. And when we then were taken to Paris and I got out, it was really like absolutely discovery of this big, big world, people rushing by looking so elegant. And I felt like my broom colored, blonde, boring self stepping into this new world. So it was quite a shock for my New Mexico culture, but I very quickly learned to love it.
For Americans, I think sometimes there's admiration, yes, for France, but sometimes there's, I think, mockery And there's also intimidation. Like you were just saying, it's so sophisticated and we can't hold up. Can you make the case that it's worth looking beyond those stereotypes and learning from the French daily life?
Absolutely. And I also think that France has changed a lot. You used to hear people saying, oh, the Parisians are so, they're not polite to you and they are so dismissive. And now I think that, you know, 20, 30 years later, they're very much more patient. But I do think, yes, especially when you get into family life and life with friends, it's a very different culture from what you might see in the more just elegant images, which are still present in the street, of course.
Talking to Kathy Yandell, author of The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World, getting some daily life lessons from her time in France. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kathy, I want to start digging into specifics here. And I'm going to start by confessing that earlier today I committed a crime under French law. I ate my lunch at my desk here at work. French law says no, right? You can't do that.
That's exactly right. The idea being that when you're at work, you work better when you separate, you know, the relaxation time. So you're encouraged to get away. I mean, by law, you're supposed to get away from your desk. Sometimes companies have cafeterias, but very frequently people will just go to a nearby cafe and have lunch away from work. Now, they made some exceptions during COVID, and I need to see whether they've continued to suspend the law or not. But absolutely, it is still on the French books that you cannot eat lunch at your place of work, at your desk.
And that really speaks to a different attitude, right, toward work in France versus here in the United States. What kind of lessons do you hope we could take from that and other examples of how France approaches work and our lives outside of work?
Well, I think the lunch example is a very good one for the idea of mini vacations, right? So that even within the course of one single day, you have to take some time out. You have to take a breath, have to get away. Maybe the sort of physical pleasures of eating or even having a little coffee at the end, the little tiny French espresso coffees, and all the while being talking with people and just enjoying a moment that isn't just caught up in the daily schedule. And I think we Americans are not quite as good at that, as being able to separate these different aspects of our lives, and they all sort of blur together.
Let's stay with the food theme. Another thing, and again, I'm very un-French in this way. When I go out to a restaurant, I want my food, I eat my food, I leave the restaurant. There's a very different attitude, it seems, from your writing in France when it comes to how food is eaten and how long one might take to do it.
Yes, that's true. I mean, especially at weddings, but we won't even go into that. I mean, those literally last all night. But just even for a daily dinner, for example, one of the examples I always think of is when you go to a restaurant in this country, sometimes the waiter will come around and just whisk away your plate, right? And even if other people at the table haven't finished, the idea is we want to clear this off. We want to get this finished. And the nice thing about France is they assume it's much more of a communitarian kind of thing. So it's not the individual finishing a plate that matters. It's that everyone at the table has finished the plate that matters. And so you're really reminded that it's a communal experience all the time. And I think maybe that's why you're supposed to get away from your desk as well, so that you can actually commune and communicate with others.
And actually, I do want to get into
part
that
of the experience.
I do want to get into that wedding, because one of your early experiences in France, you were not prepared for what went into a French wedding and the food therein. Could you share that experience with us?
Right. Well, so it was at a country home, and it was really beautiful, and there was a terrace, and we were all outside, spread out, and there's champagne and little hors d'oeuvres, and I thought, oh, this is just so wonderful. So we're having lots of hors d'oeuvres and champagne. And then we sit down and we have a Lyonnais specialty which is quenelle, and they're these little sort of dumplings with a Nantua sauce that was so wonderful. And I thought, oh, that's been a great meal. Now let's wait for the dessert. But no, that wasn't even the main course. And so the courses kept coming with the cheese. And by this time, I'm absolutely winding down and just beginning to sort of peck at the food. And then comes the big wedding pièce montée, which is kind of like a wedding cake made of different pastries. Anyway, I learned the lesson that you really need to pace yourself. But I also learned that part of the pleasure is just spending the evening discussing and exchanging and tasting the different dishes as they go by. So yes, I learned quite a bit on that evening. And then dancing, of course, that comes later.
You also,
for those who can move.
Right. Now, you also spent some time looking at art in France, and you see contrasts in how French people and their attitudes toward art go and Americans. Compare and contrast for us how we look at art.
Well, obviously, there are different aspects of this. And I would say that the French have art really around them all the time. So, you know, even in the metro, there'll be certain stations that will have different artistic works just displayed. And so I think also with the age of the buildings that are all around them, I'm talking about Paris right now, it's like art on every corner in some ways. And I think at least among my French friends, the idea of going to museums and taking in, I mean, even cinema is seen, even films are seen as, you know, not only what you do with Netflix, but definitely the experience of going to the cinema and then discussing it at great length afterwards. So again, it becomes a kind of a community experience. So I find that art is a little more integrated into daily life. One summer recently, I was there and they were doing outdoor readings in parks, and they were just free and they were sponsored by a local theater. And that sort of thing just pops up kind of everywhere.
We're talking to Kathy Yandell about her new book, The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Kathy's speaking at Boswell Books in Milwaukee tonight at 6:30. You can join the conversation here at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what she experienced in France, what she hopes to bring home to American culture? Have you been to France for work, with family, for a vacation? Was there something there that struck you as different, maybe changed the way you live your life here in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kathy Yandell about her new book. It's called The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Kathy's speaking in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee at Boswell Books today at 6:30. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Based on what you've heard, do you do things similar to what our guest is talking about in France? Do you like long, long meals at restaurants where the staff don't pick up your plates the moment you finish that last crumb of food? Do you find little ways to take time away from work, say, to find something to enjoy that little thing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. You talk in the book, Kathy, about French attitudes toward activity and exercise. Now, our producer, Colleen Leahy, studied abroad in a small town in Brittany when she was in high school, and she would go on jogs a few times a week, swim laps at a local pool, and you know, people thought she was super athletic there in France. She said, Colleen est très sportif. Colleen never saw other people jogging and got weird looks, she says. I don't know, do French people make less of a distinction between this is exercise and this is not exercise?
That's such a good question, Rob, and it's changed a lot in recent years. I mean, right now there's a humongous push because of the Olympics, and I can't quite figure out why it is that all of a sudden France wants its own population to be more sporty. But lots of, I talk about this in the book, lots of new sort of parks with exercise equipment and so on have opened up throughout Paris and throughout France. But I also want to say that there are loads of people, men, women, older, younger, running in parks now. And literally 5-10 years ago, that wasn't the case. So I think, I don't know whether it's, whether you could argue that it would be the Americanization of French culture, or maybe just the fact that having such sedentary jobs as many of us do, there's much more a push towards sports now, or if not sports, at least health culture where you're running or going to the gym or something like that. So I think Colleen's experience was really typical. I don't know how long it was ago, but in recent years, that's really changing. Some of my students, female students, even joined some female soccer teams on the outskirts of Paris. And they said there was one distinction, and that is that they found that they were a little more aggressive on the field than the French women. But the French women, you know, in the World Cup, I haven't followed the latest games, but they're a very strong team now, too. So I think the times they are a-changing.
And Kathy, you point toward throughout the book, there are tensions in France about migration and immigration, as there are here in the United States. You point to that, though, in many ways as a strength of France and to so many of the things we talk about, whether it's food or art or culture or athletics, the powerful role of immigrants in French culture. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. After the Second World War and then again after the War of Algerian Independence, a lot of people from Northern Africa who were, you know, in colonialized French countries, like particularly Morocco, but Algeria and Tunisia as well, many of them, and some from sub-Saharan Africa as well, have immigrated to France. And I really believe that it's made it a much richer country. I have a friend who recently said, without a hint of irony, that couscous is a fully French dish. Well, yes, it's become a French dish, but it's actually a North African dish, but it's just worked its way in French culture. And I think the same can be said about hai, which is a type of singing from North Africa. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is that I think it's 4 out of the past 6 years an African origin baker has won the baguette contest sponsored by the Élysée, which is like the White House in the US. And it's a blind tasting, and all these very specialized bakers from all over France taste these breads. And the one that wins will get to supply the White House, or the Élysée, for a year. And 4 out of 6 times it's been an African origin person. So I find that really interesting and heartwarming that the culture is getting so much richer by these immigrants. I'm not saying that there aren't tensions. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it isn't difficult, and also that there aren't certain people who do not like the idea of having so many immigrants. But I am saying that from my perspective, it has been a good thing.
On a related note, here in the United States, we have ongoing debates about how we tackle historical injustices, slavery and segregation, for example. You find at least some positive examples of how France talks about its history. What do you see there?
Well, there's a commission that Macron put into effect a few years ago to look into the Algerian War, for example, because part of the problem of that is a lot of censorship on both sides, not to know what was happening on the other side, but particularly in France, having covered up the torture that took place during the Algerian War of Independence. And they think that the way to healing is, of course, not to sort of pull the wool over anyone's eyes on that and to expose what really did happen. So that commission, the first iteration of that commission, I think, did not accomplish very much, but there's yet another one working on it so that the two sides can finally come together and talk about what really happened, with the idea, I think a little bit like what happened in Rwanda, of getting beyond those conflicts. So I guess like many countries, France is working on that. It is something that's in the forefront of their conversations, as well as some restitution of art objects, for example, that were more or less stolen from these different regimes during the colonial period, and some of which are now being returned to the countries in question.
Talking to Kathy Yandell, author of The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Now, Kathy, I gave a couple of examples in which I'm very un-French. I eat lunch at my desk sometimes. I blow through the restaurant meal really fast and then get out. One thing that did resonate with me, you point toward embracing the small pleasures in life. And that is something I definitely try to do, whether it's just, you know, a cup of coffee or something like that, really savoring those little things to find that joy. Could you talk about that a little?
Yes. It's just little moments of joy. And there've been several books kind of thinking about this in France recently, but it's something that I saw in France long ago of just taking the time to take a moment to appreciate this particular view. And that's what I was talking about, art as well, or this particular taste, or this particular feeling of the weather. So very much that pleasure can be found not only in these more grandiose artistic things or the absolute beauty of a mountain view or something, but can be found in these little, often sensual moments having to do with the senses.
Kathy, on a practical note, you spend obviously much of your time here in the United States, but how do you take some of these joie de vivre lessons you learned in France and put them into practice here in the United States, where sometimes our attitudes might be stumbling blocks to try to live that way?
Right. And I think everyone who comes back from France or from some country that they admire in some ways might adapt those particular rituals or ideas. But I know in family life particularly, we always made a point of having dinner and as much as we possibly could, not rushing through it, because that was a time of day to sort of have our daughters say what had happened during the week and so on. And that's not always possible because kids in this country have soccer practice and they have a band or orchestra or they have theater or a million things. But we try to keep that a little bit sacrosanct. And I know other kids in the neighborhood would, you know, grab their meals and run back outside. But we tried to have that as our one time that we could check in. And that sort of came from my French family, really trying to honor dinner time. That's one little example. Another example is just trying to incorporate ways of looking into our lives, ways of looking at art, ways of appreciating what you're seeing and talking about what you're seeing. Because I think in this country with our children, that's another thing that I learned about sort of joie de vivre, and it sounds counterintuitive, but it's that French kids are actually taught to argue and they're taught to question what's told them, even if it's by their parents in some ways. So you're having, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And that sounds like that you're learning to fight back or something. But what it ends up being is that they then know that their opinions are valued, but they have to defend them. And so I think that leads to a kind of a sense of self that's a little bit different from the one that we give our children when we say, oh, you think that? Oh, that's nice, rather than challenging them, which I think leads them to have more autonomy, which is why I think French 18-year-olds, for example, seem a lot older than American 18-year-olds.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Have a great visit to Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Kathy Yandell, professor of French and Francophone Studies at Carleton College, author of the book The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. If you're in Milwaukee, you can see her tonight at Boswell Books at 6:30.